with the Southwest ADA Center, and I will be serving as moderator for today's session. Today's program is brought to you as a collaborative effort between the Great Lakes and the Southwest ADA Centers, members of the National ADA Network. Individuals joining us today are using a variety of mediums, including the webinar platform, listening via telephone, and using real-time captioning. Today's session will include a PowerPoint presentation, and there's also a few links to some of the publications that you can download for this session. We do apologize, we got these out a bit late to you, so if you were not able to access them ahead of time, you will be able to access them later on in the archive section of the website located at www.adaaudio.org/archives/ADA Legal at the conclusion of today's program. Again, the session is being recorded, and this recording will be available for review within 24 hours of the conclusion of the session. I'd like to begin today's session by turning it over to Aaron McCullough. Aaron is an attorney for ADA Consult, and of course he's worked with the Southwest ADA Center in the past. You can read a bit more about Aaron, Jeanette, and Marty by accessing their posted bios on the website at www.ada-audio.org/webinar. And now I'll turn it over to Aaron.
Hello. Well, I do want to give you a little bit of a background of our two speakers. I'm going to be facilitating for the for these two very bright people who have generously donated their time today. Martin Ebel is the Deputy Director of the Houston District Office of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And formerly he was the General Counsel and later Commissioner of the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, where he ran the Commission's Springfield office and directed that agency's employment testing program. Before he moved to Texas, he was twice named a Massachusetts super lawyer, and he had practiced discrimination law for more than a decade. He was also an adjunct professor at the Boston College of Law, where he taught employment discrimination. In addition, we'll be joined by Professor Jeanette Cox, who is a professor at the University of Dayton School of Law, whose research focuses on disability and employment discrimination. That's why we're here. And her recent work analyzes this very topic, the conceptual relationship between the Americans with Disabilities Act and other traditional civil rights laws. She's been published extensively, and again, she wrote the article that I think inspired at least in a significant way the creation of this webcast. Moving forward, I'm going to introduce the topic just a little bit. I mentioned that Professor Cox had authored an article which she had presented back in November of 2011, I believe, and it began to kind of snowball in attention, and I first came to be aware of it via some news alerts on ADA-related topics and began to see her interviewed. I called her up and asked her, picked her brain about this this very kind of interesting connection between disability, the perception of pregnancy as a potential impairment, and the utilization of the Americans with Disabilities Act to confer protections that might not otherwise be available to women who were pregnant and being discriminated against in the workplace. And she very generously gave of her time. I kind of wanted to talk to Professor Cox a little bit about her article and give her an opportunity to kind of discuss the motivation behind it. Professor Cox, are you there? The one question I didn't ask you in the number of phone and email conversations I had is, why did you write this article?
Well, that's something that's been kicking around in my mind a lot as I've thought about the ADA is a point that I've actually heard several people with disabilities make about their experience with the ADA and ADA litigation. And that's their experience of having to go through a litigation process where they're forced to present a lot of medical testimony to show that their condition is sufficiently severe. And some folks view this process as somewhat in tension with the civil rights goal of the ADA. They to some extent have to show that they're really bad off, that we should have sympathy for them, that their life is really rough, in order for them to take advantage of a statute that ostensibly is focused not on the problem that might be inherent in their body, but on the social structures and lack of accessibility that is the fault of all of society. And kind of there's a bit of a tension there, particularly if you think about the ADA as really focusing on discrimination, the civil rights goal of really, I think the courts were very fixated on making sure, you know, people had severe enough limitations to take advantage of this, which put the attention on their limitations rather than on the social structures and discrimination that they wanted to use the ADA to challenge. So pregnancy, I thought, was an interesting kind of vehicle to think about this, because we don't think of pregnancy as an impairment. We think about it as a, certainly a biological condition, but it's something we is healthy. The medical profession doesn't classify it as a defect the way it classifies a traditional disability. And yet, we see lots of situations where the pregnant body doesn't fit with traditional work structures and work expectations. So we have the same type of situation where, because of how work has been structured historically, there's a lack of fit between a person's body and the work environment. But when it's a pregnant person, we don't have this. We have a different kind of situation where it's not actually something we label a medically diagnosed impairment that is triggering this lack of fit between the person's body and the work environment. That's a long-winded academic explanation. Is that helpful?
No, actually, undoubtedly this was a more academic article, and I think what inspired me to get a little more interested in it is I had a fairly knee-jerk reaction to it, and I noticed at least within the press and the blogosphere there was a great deal of resistance to some of the some of the ideas that you expressed in your article, which was in reviewing the article for a second and third time, I began to realize this was a really intellectual exercise, and you were looking at problems, you weren't prescribing solutions necessarily, and I just kind of want to discuss a little bit of the pushback that you seem to experience, and I read about what do you think was can you express some of the themes of resistance that you heard back about your article?
Well, there are things that I certainly expected and anticipated. One concern was that classifying pregnancy within the ADA framework would just reinvigorate an outdated stereotype as pregnancy being totally incapacitating.
An anti-feminist notion that pregnancy is unnatural or otherwise a defect.
And certainly in historical policies that took pregnant women out of the workforce because entirely, even though they still could work and do a lot of things, based on the sort of outdated assumption that once you're pregnant you can't be in the workforce. I think that the ADA is broad enough, and obviously, since it applies to employment discrimination, it's in contemplating people who still have a ton of work capacity, but just potentially need some adjustments to how work is traditionally structured in order to do it. But that's certainly an objection. The other set of objections, I think, is pretty interesting, because I think they kind of demonstrate perhaps the disability rights community's not complete success yet in convincing the public about what how we should think about disability for ADA purposes. Feminists, I got a lot of pushback from feminists, which I expected, is saying that calling pregnancy a disability or even suggesting that sort of reifies the male standard as the normal, and then any person's body that doesn't function the way a traditional able-bodied man functions is defective. which is really the argument that of the ADA itself, is that we historically have only considered a certain narrow band of people to be legitimate workers, and everyone else who doesn't have that body isn't a legitimate worker. And there, I think pregnant women are in the same boat with a lot of people with traditional disabilities, of similarly saying, well, no, I have lots to contribute, and a lot of the barriers I experience aren't the result of my body, but instead the result of how work has been structured based on the assumption that only a narrow band of the population would participate in work.
Another key point that you introduced very early in your article is the expansive nature of the ADA Amendments Act and reaching at that one old saw that we used to use in describing what is and is not a disability. It's the kind of the prognosis issue or the length and severity of the impairment, defining whether or not something's a disability. And I'm hoping that Mr. Ebel can chime in here about this. You cite the ADAA or the ADA Amendments Act, Professor Cox, mm-hmm. restating a notion that perhaps we have been excluding more people than we should, using that sort of rubric of consideration. We never said you would have to be disabled or impaired rather for 6 months to a year, but we talked about things in terms of is this likely to be long in term or permanent impairing condition, and in the back of of everybody's mind, be you an HR professional, an attorney, or somebody providing technical assistance on the ADA, I mean, everybody had a number in mind, how many months or how many years might they be affected, the difference between, a minor fracture in a leg to a nearly completely ruined leg. And I believe fairly early, and again in your article, you cite the ADAA has kind of again redefined this.
Right, and I rely a lot on the EEOC's regs, particularly the deletion of a lot of that old language that was in the regs about it being a long-term condition, and particularly the EEOC's position that it can last less than 6 months. And then I've heard Chai Feldblum say, it could last a moment if it was sufficiently severe. That might have been a bit of hyperbole, but I've heard her repeatedly say that, there's not a time limitation anymore. So I'm very much relying on the way the EEOC has interpreted the ADAA to not impose those permanent long-term kind of requirements that a lot of courts had previously imposed. And yeah, that was usually the easiest way to say pregnancy didn't fit, was that it's inherently a short-term condition, right?
Mr. Ebel?
Yeah, I think that's right. Pre-ADAA, there was an awful lot of case law that looked to the temporary nature of pregnancy and cited that as a reason for no coverage, because there was this understanding that the ADA did not cover transitory and minor conditions, transitory or minor conditions. And of course, that's been turned on its head now. And instead, what we say expressly in the regs is that only a condition that is both transitory and minor will be excluded from coverage. And so I've also heard Chai Feldblum say repeatedly that it doesn't matter how long the disability takes place. If it's a disabling condition under the terms of the law, it's covered. And to go back to your example, a broken leg, a minor broken leg, is in fact, from our perspective, a disability under the ADAA.
Which inarguably would not have been before the passage of the law.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And just to kind of continue on using Professor Cox's article as a framework, you review the protections for women who are pregnant under the existing law, and I'm hoping that you'll both chime in and discuss both the adequacies and the inadequacies of the existing law. For example, I know that a lot of folks, maybe not this audience, But a lot of folks that we encountered when I was working for the DivTech and providing, or the disability, the ADA centers and providing technical assistance, they were unaware that there was a Pregnancy Discrimination Act, and they were unaware particularly of some of the protections underneath the Family Medical Leave Act. I'm hoping that Professor Kasha, in your article, you discussed some, you know, again, some of the protections and some of the inadequacies. Can you kind of hold forth on that some?
Yeah, certainly. A lot of people, I think, would have hope that the Pregnancy Discrimination Act would resolve this problem. I mean, it's an act specifically designed to deal with pregnancy discrimination, so you would think that it would. The difficulty, though, and this isn't quite universal among courts, but seems to be the trend among many in many jurisdictions, is to read the portion of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act that requires employers to treat pregnant women the same as other workers, is to really require a pregnant plaintiff to prove that someone who got the accommodation she desired is identically situated to her. And so I predict in the article, and I have some cases that suggest this may be the case, at least in some circuits, is that when an employer provides an ADA accommodation to someone who clearly falls within the ADA because they have something that we would classify as an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity, a pregnant plaintiff who, absent my argument in making this article, which courts probably aren't going to accept, we don't consider pregnancy itself an impairment, she's going to have a hard time arguing that she should get the accommodation that the ADA-covered person should receive, because the court will point to the fact, well, the person that received the accommodation is covered by the ADA and the pregnant woman is not. And because of that kind of narrow structure and the way courts have interpreted the Pregnancy Discrimination Act to force the plaintiff to point to someone else who's received the accommodation she wants and say that person is similarly situated to her, now that the ADA is broad enough that it, you know, covers someone with a broken leg, pretty much anybody an employer would accommodate is probably covered by the ADA at this point. And so if the pregnant worker it loses out and doesn't receive that accommodation, it's going to be hard for her to have a comparator, someone who doesn't fit within the ADA, that she could argue she should receive what they got and that it's discrimination.
So
I was a little convoluted. Does that make sense?
It does. In addition, I was just kind of trying to define better for the audience who, again, who may not be aware, what are the confines of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act? I mean, how do you, you know, it's... Ms. Riegel?
The Pregnancy Discrimination Act essentially redefines or adds to the definition of because of sex or on the basis of sex, which is included in Title VII. To include, but not be limited to, pregnancy because of pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions, and women affected by pregnancy, childbirth, and related medical conditions, and they shall be treated the same for all employment-related purposes, including receipt of benefits under fringe benefit programs, as other persons not so affected, but similar in their ability or inability to work. And the key here is that pregnant women shall be treated the same as others not so affected, but similar in their ability or inability to work. So if a pregnant woman, for example, can't stand for an extended period of time and she's in a job that requires her to stand for an extended period of time and she asks for and is denied the use of a stool where a similarly situated person with some sort of a back disable who's limited in their ability to stand for extended period of time is granted an accommodation in the use of a stool, our understanding of the PDA, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, is that she should be also granted that similar accommodation because that would be treating her the same way as somebody else who had a similar impairment and it affected their ability or inability to work. Now, admittedly, not all the courts have adopted that approach to this. We've not had a lot of widespread, uniform adoption of what the ADAAA has worked on the Americans with Disabilities Act as yet.
I think it's wonderful. I think the EEOC is pushing that position, though, because I think that's very, very helpful because if employers are persuaded they need to provide pregnant workers the same as what they provide other workers, then the ADAAA largely solves the problem for pregnant workers.
I think that's right, and the commission had a meeting on this a few months back and spoke with a number of groups and academics and women who have been through pregnancy about these very issues. And a number of times, Heifel-Bloom and other commissioners expressed this intention that we at least interpret our responsibilities under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act and the ADAAA in this way.
And I want to point back to the slide that's in front of the audience right now, the label, the scope of the problem. I have to ask this, is this kind of interest of the EEOC in extending this, extending or widening the coverage under the PDA, is that in response to, I think, the significant uptick in charges of pregnancy-based discrimination?
You know, I don't think it is. I think it's more in response to the expanded coverage under the ADAAA.
Okay. I have to ask that, too. Does the EEOC engage in any speculation as to why we saw such a significant trending up of this type of discrimination charge?
No, I don't think that we have. I don't think we've done that level of analysis on pregnancy charges. If we have, I'm not aware of it.
Okay. Let's see, moving forward. In reading her and Professor Cox's articles and looking at some of the recent litigation and news reports that talks about potential litigation and discrimination complaints against women who were pregnant, there seem to be, basically two types of cases like this, at least with women who are currently pregnant. And one was a failure to accommodate in a workplace accommodation. Another one was a failure to accommodate with some additional leave. And instead of providing the stool, they did not. And then the other cases tend to be sort of leave. At least in those cases in front of the EEOC recently, Mr. Evil, what are you seeing in terms of those two, types of discrimination?
Well, we're certainly seeing both of them, but I think that at least in the Houston District Office, and I really can't speak with great authority to what's going on in the rest of the country because I don't see the statistics nationally often enough. But with regard to our office, the leave cases are outpacing the failure to accommodate cases. We're seeing a lot more leave cases. And they tend to be centered on policies of the employer where the employer has a hard and fast line in the sand that at either the end of the 12-week FMLA leave, the mandatory FMLA leave for employers over 50, or at some other point in time, but usually a defined and set time, that if a person is unable to return to work with 100% medical clearance, that is with no restrictions, that their employment will be terminated. So we're seeing a lot of those cases, and we're chasing them very hard because we think that those are systemic violations that result in classes of people being discriminated against. It's not just the single person who brings it to our attention. It's going to be every woman who needs a longer maternity leave and every disabled person who needs more than 12 weeks of contiguous or intermittent leave in a year who is potentially discriminated against in one of those cases because it effectively cheats them out of the interactive process.
Okay. Can you advance the slide, please, Melissa? We'll get back to that point here in a bit. I'm sorry, I kind of lost my place here a little bit. I'll admit to that. I was also hoping, since you were talking about the Houston office, that what prompted me to call you was a post-pregnancy issue. was a case in front of the Southern District that made national news. And it's a little bit off topic, but I think it is broadly captured underneath this pregnancy and pregnancy-related discrimination. This was a case involving a woman who was hoping to be accommodated to have time to release breast milk. I was hoping you could just kind of describe that case a little bit.
Talking about the Houston funding case, I presume.
I believe so, yes.
And that's a case where a woman, she was a project manager for Houston funding, and she was taking pregnancy leave. During the course of her maternity leave, she didn't communicate real well with her employer about what her intentions were and plans were for return to work. She did tell one supervisor unequivocally that she intended to return but didn't yet know when that would be. She had to be cleared by her doctor. She had had a cesarean birth and there were some complications. That supervisor ended up leaving the company and before her maternity leave was over, before she returned to work. And so that information didn't make it to the people who remained, the decision makers who were left in the company. And in fact, about a week before the plaintiff was able to get her doctor's release to go back to work, they had a meeting, or at least they allegedly had a meeting, and talked about her employment, her continuing employment, and determined that she had abandoned her job because she wasn't telling them what was going on, and they decided, and I put quotation fingers around, they decided to terminate her during that meeting. Now, they decided that it would have an effective date 3 days later. 4 days after they made that decision, the plaintiff asked to return to her work, and she at the same time asked to be allowed to pump in the workplace. 10 days after that, the employer mailed her a letter saying that she was terminated for job abandonment, but they named the effective date as the day that she sought to return from the leave. So their story kind of didn't mesh up very well. So they fired her. She filed with us. We advanced the case. Judge Lynn Hughes, who heard it in the district court, and Lynn is a man, not a woman, decided that lactation was not covered by the Pregnancy Discrimination Act or by Title VII in a summary judgment opinion that is really summary. It's like 2.5 pages long. And basically he said it's not covered, and he didn't say very much why. He dropped a footnote with a couple of case sites, but it turns out that the cases he was citing to were based on law that's pretty much been overturned by the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. The long and the short of it is we've appealed this case to the Fifth Circuit. It has been briefed. It has not yet been argued. And it's not 100% clear whether there's going to be oral argument on this case. But we've made two main arguments. And the first is that firing a female employee because she's lactating violates Title VII. It violates the general prohibition on sex discrimination because this is an inherently sex-linked trait or function, lactation, sex-linked. And any adverse action that's based on that is going to be a violation of Title VII. The second argument that we've made is that even if you don't buy that, firing a female employee because she's lactating also violates the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, because of the specific statutory prohibition on discrimination based on pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions. We think it's pretty clear that a lactating female is suffering from a related medical condition, or perhaps not suffering, but subject to one, and that the only way that you're typically going to be lactating is if you've been pregnant. And so those are the arguments that we're making on appeal, and we're quite hopeful that it will be, in fact, overturned.
Well, again, this was a case that got a great deal of national attention, I think, and kind of kept this broader notion of pregnancy-related discrimination alive for quite some time. In fact, it's still being debated, again, in the blogosphere, with people falling, it's seemingly pretty polarized, on both sides. It really lit up. A lot of people, and I think, got a great deal of attention to the issue. Not all good, but it was, as I kind of indicated to you earlier, it was kind of an irresistible case. Because it really it really jumped at you in terms of where you're going to fall, and you know, on as somebody, you know, are you somebody who values family? I mean, these are essential issues. Have you accepted civil rights or the notion, or you know, that you should support and that should be supported in the, to prevent discrimination in the workplace? And again, it seems a very polarizing case.
Yeah, I think that's right. One of the things that I found out, and this is really interesting, we haven't made this argument before the appeals court, but we may make these arguments in the future. As I was preparing for today's presentation, I came across the source of the recent requirement that employers who have 50 or more employees have to provide lactation rooms for breastfeeding mothers. That comes from the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, and it's administered by DOJ. And everybody with more than 50 employees has to provide it. And employers with fewer than 50 employees only can get out of it after they successfully petition for an exemption and are able to demonstrate some sort of an undue hardship. Now, it just seems passing strange to me that one portion of the law can mandate that we have to have lactation rooms for breastfeeding mothers, and yet the other part of the law that we enforce would somehow be interpreted to not require that the employer actually let the woman use that required lactation room. So I think the dichotomy there is really interesting.
Well, I kind of want to move forward into some speculation, and I'm hoping that you two will join me just a little bit. Understanding that, I'm going to take the position, and I don't think either one of you would disagree, that discrimination against women who are pregnant or who have recently been pregnant does exist. It is a problem, and it's a problem that could be remediated with law, or at least somewhat remediated with law. And I guess there's an opportunity to do a few things, and I guess in earlier discussions with Professor Cox, at least very early in my discussions with her, I think I had expressed to her the same kind of fear that a lot of folks who've been working with the ADA have about opening up the ADA in this climate. Is opening up the Americans with Disabilities Act in an arguably somewhat hostile climate, anti-civil rights climate that there is that a wise thing to do? And again, that's kind of that cowardly take, and I'll admit to that. But assuming that we do need to find a remedy, and I believe that we do, I'll represent myself as somebody that believes that we shouldn't discriminate against pregnant women in the workplace. If we try to solve that as an issue, how should this be done? Should we expand the ADA, continue to expand the ADA, or utilize the ADA Amendments Act? Should we expand the PDA, or should we do something else? Then I'm just kind of hoping that you guys will offer your opinion. Ms. Rubel?
Well, let me preface this with, this is my personal opinion, and you can't attribute my opinion to the agency, or they'll get mad at me. But on a going forward basis, I think two things are required. I think the first is that we need to enforce the ADAAA in the spirit in which it was intended and it was enacted, and that is to set the clock back to where we were in the early 1990s when this thing was first passed, and understand that we're not supposed to be arguing about who's covered. And I think that's probably the biggest part of it. And I think if we can do that, we'll go a long way toward addressing the concerns that you have and that we're here to talk about today. If that's insufficient, then I think that the approach ought to be to work on the PDA rather than on the Americans with Disabilities Act, because I think that the backlash that's likely to come from the women's community to be characterizing pregnancy as a disability, I just think is inherently wrong. I don't think any woman is going to feel particularly good about that unless, of course, there's some sort of complication with the pregnancy. So my suggestion would be to beef up the Pregnancy Discrimination Act in order to make it abundantly clear that we think that there are certain things that should be done for a woman who's pregnant.
And just to reiterate that point, I think there is I don't think it's a strictly a pro-feminist notion now, but the notion that labeling an otherwise uncomplicated pregnancy as an impairment is like ashes in the mouth of people who have a many women and certainly the most feminist that I've read. So I guess, Professor Cox, what's your opinion?
I don't disagree. I mean, I think there's.
I'm hoping you disagree.
I don't disagree with the strategy. I guess I somewhat want to push back a little bit on the perception of what disability means, but on the strategy, I think it probably does make the most sense if we can't do this either by interpretations of the ADAAA or the Pregnancy Discrimination Act to have legislation that deals particularly with accommodations during pregnancy. And I think the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act that's been proposed appears to be a good avenue to do that. Now, I don't know that will necessarily succeed, but there seems to be some momentum building around that approach of expressly adopting an accommodations approach for pregnancy. But I do want to push back a little bit against the sort of idea that calling pregnancy a disability necessarily has to be offensive, because I think there's some value in thinking about, for ADA purposes, we're not talking about disability necessarily as this inherent physiological tragedy. And I think we're encompassing more civil rights notion that a lot of the limitations associated with disabilities, I think as the general public who isn't affected by disability just assumes that's all just because of biology or tragedy someone experienced. I think that obscures the fact that so much of the disadvantage that people with disabilities experience is not inevitable result of their biology. Instead, it's a lot of it socially imposed. And so I think there is some value in thinking about a disability statute really focusing on discrimination and the historical effects of that discrimination in workplaces that aren't physically accessible and don't have policies that are accessible, of saying that the problem we're getting at is really the socially imposed problem, which doesn't necessarily require a person with a disability to even agree with the notion that their body is inherently defective.
About the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act was introduced in May, and we talked a little bit about that on the phone this morning. I really did not say it in depth, but I mean it seems to be making precisely this argument that we should require reasonable accommodations for pregnancy, childbirth, all the related medical conditions, but setting up a very ADA-like analysis, right? An undue hardship analysis. Is that how you understand it?
I understand it's very much borrowing the framework of the ADA for pregnancy, accommodations needed during pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to be a sort of unilateral introduction. I mean, it doesn't have a lot of bipartisan support right now, does it?
I honestly am not that dialed into the politics of it, but no, my impression is that it does not yet have a lot of bipartisan support.
Okay. I was hoping that we could entertain some questions now before we move in. I know that we have some because I've got some in advance. Melissa?
I have one question that I've received. What about cases where the birth of a child results in complications with the with regards to the child, and the parent ends up needing extra care beyond what is allowed for maternity leave? Does that then still fall under maternity leave, or would it then fall under FMLA?
I think I think the issue is most concepts of maternity leave, unless there's a policy of an employer and a different maternity leave built into their benefits, would normally employers are looking at the Family Medical Leave Act. They call it maternity leave. Am I reading something else into the question?
No, I think you're right. You guys touched on this just a couple of moments ago. I think they were asking for if it requires more than whatever their employer allots, then they were trying to see if, I guess, find out if there's a clarification there.
You know, I think that there's frequently a question from that I hear a lot about, can I get an accommodation to care for my disabled child? And if that's what this question is getting to, I think the answer is, unfortunately, no. That the Americans with Disabilities Act only grants accommodations to those who have the disability and not to those who do not. So caring for a child or being regarded as disabled disqualifies you for an accommodation, at least on that basis.
Okay, I think that's the only question we've gotten so far. I'll just remind folks real quick, if you have a question, please feel free to type it into that chat area there, and I will see it. Aaron?
And I have other questions that were actually sent in beforehand. This I think was a somewhat predictable direction this would go in, since we frame this as more of a narrower employment-related concern. If we're expanding the protections of the Americans with Disabilities Act potentially into covering women who are pregnant who have complications related to and needs of accommodation related to their pregnancy, what about outside the employment arena? And particularly, this question was about discrimination against pregnant teens in schools and in other settings. I know Martin, that you work for the EEOC, but you're an experienced civil rights attorney, and I know Professor Cross and I have discussed this. I mean, does this expansion under the ADAAA still have legs if you take it out of Title I?
I mean, I think the it depends on whether you're doing the approach that I advocate in the article, which I will admit is going to be a hard sell for a lot of courts, of saying that pregnancy actually is something we can classify as an impairment under the ADA, versus the approach that Deputy Director Ebel was describing of saying that the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, by prohibiting employers from treating pregnant workers differently from other people who need accommodations. I mean, that approach, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, just prohibits discrimination in employment. So that would only cover employment. Now, if we actually are talking about pregnancy constituting as something that we're calling a disability under the ADA itself, then of course that definition of disability doesn't just apply to Title I, it applies to all of the ADA.
Of course, on balance, we only have jurisdiction on Title I. Our regulations speak quite directly to this, and we say expressly that pregnancy is not an impairment that's covered under the ADA unless there are complications. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it bleeds over into Title II or Title III, because we don't have control over them.
And again, I knew that this was the direction that it would take, but the DOJ wouldn't necessarily follow the EEOC down this yellow brick road, but I knew that we would get some questions on this matter. But I think it speaks more broadly to the fact that no matter how much we may have progressed in terms of fighting gender-based discrimination, and providing some remedies in the workplace, it's occurring outside the workplace, and it's still an issue. I don't think that we have an answer to a specific question as I was asked, and I'll try to respond to that person more directly with a referral. But I'm actually hoping that we'll get a couple of more questions, but I wanted to talk a little bit, and probably particularly with Professor Cox, about state law protections that maybe take a more expansive view of protections for women who are pregnant or will become pregnant. And I'm speaking specifically of laws such as Michigan's, which Michigan in 2010 amended their pregnancy and their anti-discrimination protection for women who are pregnant. I believe it's the Elliott-Larsen Civil Rights Act, and its language seems to be suggesting that pregnancy is almost like to be treated like a workplace injury. Interestingly enough, and speaks to providing a light duty as an accommodation for its employers for its employees. And I know that undoubtedly it's. The state can influence the direction that the federal government goes in creating and amending civil rights protection. And I was just curious for both of you if you see a trend in state law that way, and whether in your opinion about state law providing more expansive protection.
Well, a lot of the advocacy pieces I've seen for the Pregnant Workers Protection Act really have relied on the California statute as a model. There's some variation amongst what different states have done. Some states just provide accommodations for people in certain professions, like police and firefighting work, where the other states, like California, are broader. And I think what those state statutes have suggested is that this isn't that big of an imposition on employers. Employers are able to provide what are usually very modest, simple accommodations. And there honestly hasn't been that much litigation. One of the most compelling things I was reading earlier today in a piece by the Equal Rights Advocates group was that in contrast to EEOC filings on pregnancy discrimination that have gone up dramatically, remember that slide that you showed earlier, they've gone up dramatically in the past several years, filings actually in California have gone down, and they attributed that to the fact that employers in California know they are supposed to be flexible and accommodating of pregnancy, so there hasn't been a need for litigation.
You know, and that parallels the experience that we had in Massachusetts when I was with the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination. There was a really strong maternity leave act in Massachusetts that I think put employers on notice about their responsibilities, and it really led to a much smaller, as a percentage of the total filings, pregnancy complaint at the Massachusetts Commission than we typically see nationwide. So I think you're right that strong laws can really help with this. I also think that we've seen historically that the civil rights enactments of the states are the things that eventually kind of move the Fed off of the schneid.
Right.
You know, the states lead in these areas oftentimes.
And to be honest, movement at the state level is a lot more accessible. I for the advocates out there, I think that they all too often ignore the opportunities to act more regionally rather than bemoan what the federal government is not doing. I guess, Marissa, are there any additional questions?
Oh, yes. We've got a lot of questions that came in. Let me start here with the first one. Which federal circuits, if any, have ruled that pregnant employees must be accommodated if similarly situated employees have been accommodated?
Professor Cox, throw that out to our two speakers.
My understanding of this, and Professor Cox may have better information than I do, but my understanding on this is that there has been no circuit that has ruled on this since the ADAAA.
No, certainly not since the ADAAA. No. Prior to the ADAAA, there were cases that went the other direction,
right,
of course,
right.
But no, not
right.
Since the ADAAA.
Okay. Our next question is, what is the law to, I believe, when you were talking about lactating rooms, and how a company must apply as far as breaks and other things. So can you go into it a little bit more regarding that law? And they also want to know, what about parking lots and off-site transport?
Well, I'm not sure that any of that is covered by the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. I think that what it says is there just must be a lactation room. There's no meaningful language about its use or its frequency of use. Instead, it's that it must be private. It must be you must be able to not be disturbed while you're in it. The door has to lock. I think if it's got windows, you got to have shades on the windows, that kind of thing. But it does not speak to the frequency or the use of those rooms.
It's my impression, my memory, it's been a couple months since I read it, but I thought it did say something about reasonable periods of time to take breaks, unpaid breaks, mind you. But I think that it does have language that says that there's a reasonable, I mean, that obviously reasonable obviously isn't a very firm kind of requirement, but I think that kind of can signal that you can rely on the medical community to provide some information about how often someone needs to express breast milk at various stages post-pregnancy.
Boy, and that sounds a lot like the ADA language, doesn't it? Reasonable.
Right. Oh, exactly. Exactly.
I like it.
Is there any additional questions?
Yes, actually. The next question is, they're asking about a police officer. They would like to find out about, there's a police officer, I guess, that's through various back-to-back pregnancies, has not been performing her essential functions of her job for several years. These pregnancies are normal, just consecutive. She's requesting an accommodation under ADA relating to performing several essential functions. In essence, the employee has not performed as a police officer for several years.
That's a pretty loaded question, and I'm going to set it up a little bit and hand it over to the two speakers. But again, all too often in my experience, employers, human resource professionals may not have clearly defined what the essential job duties are, or may have a skewed perspective on what they are, assuming that they don't under these circumstances, and that they are framing this question particularly in what are clearly the essential job duties of this police officer. What think you two?
I think an important part of the equation is how does this police department treat people who, for other reasons, who are unable to perform essential job functions. So do they have light duty positions that are given out for other reasons? I think that's an important thing to explore, because as Mr. Ebel was discussing, the EEOC's position is that the Pregnancy Discrimination Act requires employers to treat pregnant workers the same as other people who are similarly situated in their ability or inability to work.
Yeah, I agree with that. However, if there's a complication to the pregnancy or the childbirth that's involved here, that might take us into a different sphere where there could be all kinds of other accommodations that are necessary. If we truly get into the ADA because there's been a complication with the pregnancy, then of course that entire sheaf of remedies is available mm-hmm. to the employee.
Okay. Our last question is, what is your opinion of an employee requesting a shift change from night to day in order to express milk for a 2-year period? The employee states that lack of sleep affects the production of milk and has caused stress. So the lactation for a 2-year period is a personal preference and not mandated by a medical provider.
So this question is really hinging on the length of time that this woman wants to...
Yes.
It's still an argument of reasonableness, isn't it? I mean, and of course the question is begging that it's not mandated by a medical provider. Well, if you're analyzing this from an ADA perspective, I mean, a prosthetic's not necessarily mandated, that they're choosing this, and there is a medical, a medical reason for doing it, assuming that the claim of the employee is true. So how reasonable is 2 years? Again, I think that's, you know, vulnerable to, and I'm willing to bet both the speakers will agree, it's vulnerable to an analysis of what's the workplace like. Is it reasonable under these circumstances? Do you guys have a different analysis?
Well, maybe a little bit. I think I would want to know how others who are asking for shift changes or shift adjustments are being treated. And if there are others who get fairly long-term shift adjustments for other sorts of reasons, like sleep deprivation, then I think that the PDA demands that this pregnant woman who's lactating do get the same accommodation. I think that's just how it works. If, however, there are not, then I think that the analysis is a little bit different.
Professor Cox, do you have a different opinion?
No, I think that's right. That to look at how other people are treated, I think is the way to go there.
Okay. Although I am concerned with an employer who's trying to make a value judgment on precisely how long a woman should be breastfeeding her child. I'm not sure that that's in the purview of the employment relationship.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think the World Health Organization says 2 years is the recommendation these days. And so I think it's kind of an American assumption that the shorter period is appropriate. Although I will say, I think the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act puts some sort of time limitation on when employers have to provide those breaks to express milk. So that, to some extent, perhaps expresses some extent of a value judgment embedded in that statute. I don't think that should be controlling here, but that just sprung to mind as I believe that statute does put some sort of, I remember thinking it was actually fairly short, maybe 6 months to a year limitation.
Okay, we've had actually two more questions come in. This next one is, how is FMLA affected, or how is a woman protected when she needs to be on bed rest prior to the end of her pregnancy due to complications?
Well, I guess there are a couple of protections available to that particular situation. First of all, assuming that the employer has 50 or more employees, then this employee is going to be entitled to 12 weeks of paid or unpaid leave under the FMLA. That's a kind of a starting point. And the beauty of that statute, I think, is that it protects a person's job so that at the end of that 12-week period, they get to go back into the same or a similar position. They're not bumped, they're not removed, they're not fired unless there's some sort of an elimination of positions that occurs while they're out. The other thing that I think is implicated in this hypothetical is that because there are complications to this pregnancy, again, this is a woman who's going to be entitled to all the protections under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so leave is often a reasonable accommodation, and leave as a reasonable accommodation can often exceed 12 weeks.
Okay, Marissa, your next question?
Next question I think they're going back to the example of if a broken leg is considered a disability, is there such a thing as a temporary disability? Can you give some examples of this?
You mean something that wouldn't be covered by the ADA is what I'm assuming they're asking
right.
You.
Yeah, I think maybe they misunderstood.
A broken leg is a temporary. I'm sorry.
Temporary, sorry.
Go ahead.
Ms. Riegel?
A broken leg is, in fact, a temporary disability. The things that are excluded from coverage under the Americans with Disabilities Act now are things that are both minor and transitory. So it's something that's little and that doesn't last very long. The best example of that is the common cold or the flu.
But my guess is, from a human resource perspective, because they want to draw that line fairly broadly. I mean, is a sprained wrist. Is that considered a disability? I don't think that there's a way to answer that and draw that bright line for the people who have to put this into practice.
Well, I think that's right. You know, one of the things that I beat the drum on repeatedly in this field is that the Americans with Disabilities Act requires an individualized analysis. And bright lines, I think, are really dangerous when you're trying to determine the application of the ADA. So a sprained wrist might be severe enough to warrant coverage. It's certainly almost going to be, certainly usually temporary, but a severely sprained wrist in a certain situation for a certain person, let's say it's a person that's only got one hand, a sprained wrist, well, you know, that could be a disability. But again, it's an individualized analysis.
Now, I actually got a question, another question emailed to me, and it's, and I don't know whether Marissa has any other part, but in, there may be after this, but this person is expressing a concern that the application of the ADA in leave circumstances is really only being used, I guess what they're saying is really only being used where FMLA is unavailable. They're concerned that it's just a substitution, that I'm assuming what they're saying is perhaps an employee who hasn't, a part-time employee who hasn't had the hours in service necessary or works for an employer that's too small to be covered by the Family Medical Leave Act. And they're, I guess their concern that they're expressing here, their question that they're expressing here is this just an excuse? And I'm gonna guess that you're gonna say no, Mr. Abel.
Okay, well then I don't have to. But I think that it's just not. Certainly it can be. There are undoubtedly people who take advantage of this and other laws and try to, you know, game the system. But your individualized analysis should pick that sort of thing up.
Lisa, are there any additional questions?
We have one more. They're asking, is a federal government entity that employs greater than 50 employees required by law to allow more than 12 weeks?
Well, the short answer is it depends, and I think the longer answer is you have to do that individualized analysis. FMLA does apply to the federal government. The ADA does not apply to the federal government, but the Rehab Act does, and you know there's so little difference between how the two work that it's really not worth talking about in this forum. The long and the short of it, I think, is that you've got to take a look at whether a longer leave period is an appropriate and reasonable accommodation. And if it is, you have to grant it, even if you're a federal employer.
Okay, one more question, Marty. They're asking, how does ADA not apply to federal government? Can you elaborate?
Yeah, well, by its own terms, it's not applicable to the federal government. The Rehab Act instead is the vehicle that covers anti-discrimination provisions for people with disabilities in the federal government. The Rehab Act has been around longer than the ADA. Federal employees have had protections longer than the general public have in the workplace.
Okay.
Well, if we're out of questions, there's nothing really wrong with terminating this a little bit earlier, but this is an opportunity. We'll give some folks just a little bit of time. If you've got a question, send it in quickly.
As soon as you said that, we've got one more question in.
Yes.
What about a situation where someone uses all of their available FMLA leave due to a medical condition found during pregnancy, yet then is granted additional leave for the medical condition as an ADA accommodation after the birth of a child and after returning to work, the employee is needing to take additional time to care for a sick infant. Because she used all her leave for the ADA need, is there any obligation to provide leave for the sick child?
Well, Professor Cox may have a different take on this, but I think the answer is no, until and unless the year passes during which the employer is obligated to provide the 12 weeks, I don't believe there's an obligation to accommodate leave requests for caretaking responsibilities under the ADA. And if the federal leave requirement under FMLA has been used up, it's been used up. And there won't be any more until, well, it depends on how, some employers do that on a cliff vesting basis where they draw a line in the sand and they say, here's the date. You get 12 months from January 1 to December 31. You get 12 weeks. Some people say you can't take more than 12 weeks in any 12-month period. So, as every month passes, you get a little bit more. You get another week essentially, and the employer gets to choose that. But after they've made that choice, if the employee is out, the employee is out.
Okay. Next question. Doesn't the ADA cover association with a person with a disability?
I think the answer to that is absolutely it does.
I think that might be in connection with our earlier conversation, though. I think this person might ask the question earlier as saying that when we're talking about accommodations not being available
right. To
care for a child with a disability, I don't think you can interpret the ADA to go that far. It's a separate provision. You're prohibited against discrimination from your association with a person with disability. And potentially that includes like a disparate impact type of claim, but it would be hard to say a reasonable accommodation provision would be applicable.
And I think we might actually need to expand on that and make that really clear. The association issue is, you cannot be discriminated against because of your association with somebody, your spouse, a child, but that doesn't mean you're getting accommodated or that you would be accommodated to meet their particular needs related to their disabilities. I think that bears saying.
Yeah, and I think that's right. You do not get an accommodation because someone you associate has a disability. You only get an accommodation if you yourself have a disability. And for you yourself, if you claim a regarded as disabled theory instead of a failure to accommodate theory, you're also not entitled to an accommodation. Those are the two circumstances where you don't get one.
Okay. Next question is, under Title IX regs, a school employee's pregnancy is to be treated in the same manner as a temporary disability. Does that put it in conflict with the EEOC's understanding of the ADAA?
Oh, I don't think so, because I think that the pragmatic end result is that the analysis is the same under either framework. You get to the same result.
Any additional questions, Marissa?
The last one is asking for some clarification, I believe. Can you repeat with regards to the only two instances that you don't get accommodations?
As far as I can tell, I think that the two places where you don't get accommodation are when the disability that we're talking about is not your own. So in other words, you have a child or a friend or a spouse or a family member that you associate with that needs an accommodation. You don't get an accommodation. I had for years a woman that worked for me who had a son with a disability, and she always asked for accommodations for her son. And we always had to say, I'm sorry, we can't accommodate that. The other place where you cannot get an accommodation is if you're making the claim that your employer regards you as disabled. Because implicit in that is that you're not, even if you are, unfortunately. And so whenever the three prongs for these disability claims, that you have been treated differently because you have a disability, that you have been regarded as having a disability, and help me out, Professor Cox, third one.
A record.
Record, thank you. Yeah, record of a disability. So record of an actual disability will get you an accommodation, but regarded as disabled will not. Does that sound right to you, Professor Cox?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's right. Okay. That's what the EEOC's regs say.
Couple more questions. What about mental health after childbirth? Is that covered? If they're having a mental health issue.
Certainly, and if it constitutes a physical or in this case probably mental impairment, right? So same sort of requirements of documenting the impairment.
Like postpartum depression maybe or...
Yeah, I think that's right. If there's a mental impairment, that can, you know, and that can be an emotional problem, it can be a depression, it can be a mental illness problem, it can be a cognitive problem, those all would qualify as impairments under the ADAAA. And we really shouldn't be delving into, you know, is this severe enough to trigger the act? If they're telling us they've got it, I think that we should be approaching this the same way that we do with race, with national. Let me be clear. With a race claim, we don't ask for a DNA test to find out what race somebody is. With a national origin claim, we don't ask to see your visa or look at ancestry.com to see where your great-great-great-great-grandparents came from on the boat. You know, that's just not the way we do it. With religion, we don't even require that you belong to an organized religion. We just ask that you have a sincerely held belief. We're not looking under the hood on any of these other areas. We don't demand a birth certificate for an age claim. So with a disability claim, it should be the same way. We've tried to conform, I think, the way that we think about these claims in the disability setting the same way that we do in the other Title VII sorts of scenarios.
Okay. One question that just came into me is, are there any cases that you all have seen with regards to fathers or males in this case, as opposed to female-related cases in discrimination?
I guess you're maybe a paternity leave issue, but I'm not seeing a related concern here. I guess we'll make this clear. Fathers are not covered under the PDA.
Yeah,
and fathers don't have medical conditions related to their pregnancy. Is that, Mr. Evil and Professor Cox, would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, of course, the FMLA could give a father leave time to care for an infant. But right, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act would apply.
Well, let me point out that we have issued guidance under the sex rubric, though, that says that if you have a maternity leave policy without a corresponding paternity leave policy, you may be running afoul of Title VII sex protections. So if you're giving women time off after the birth of the child to bond with the child, you need to give men a similar leave scenario.
Right, I think that makes a lot of sense. If it goes beyond sort of the medical needs of recovery from childbirth at that point, right, that's something that you would be treating men differently than women and discriminating if you did not provide the same type of leave to men.
Okay, and one more question. Is it different if the person has adopted an infant, or would the same rules apply as far as maternity leave?
Well, that was actually the example that kind of springs to mind. We're talking about the differences in how you treat men and women. I mean, they're obviously medically the mother and father are in the same position, right? Right. So if you're giving leave, you need to treat men and women the same. That's kind of the quintessential example there. In that circumstance, really FMLA is what you need to worry about there, because it's not the pregnancy of the adoptive parent that we're talking about. And unless the adoptive parent develops some sort of impairment, the ADA wouldn't apply.
And I guess that you need to look to the appropriate state law as well. I know that there are a number of jurisdictions that have some protections for parental leave in adoption situations. Massachusetts comes to mind. They have a a mass maternity leave act that is, for my money, unlawful under federal law because it only protects women, but it does protect both natural childbirth and adoption. And so the mother is entitled to 8 weeks of leave after the birth or adoption of a child, which is kind of a funny scenario when you play that out, because in Massachusetts you can have gay marriage, and so two women can be married and adopt a child, and they each are entitled to 8 weeks of leave.
And I'm surprised nobody's challenged that yet.
Well, I did before I left, but I didn't stick around to see it through.
Wow.
Two men who are married and adopt are entitled to absolutely no leave whatsoever.
Yeah.
Under state law. Under federal law, I think that's wrong. But
mm-hmm. Right.
Interesting. Any questions?
Yeah, one more that's come in. And hopefully, I think it's relating back to the to a previous question with regards to how is federal government able to require or offer maternity leave, just FMLA, and where does ADA come in, or how can it be used after pregnancy if the majority of FMLA was used for pregnancy complications?
Well, again, I think the Rehab Act requires accommodations, including leave accommodations, in excess of that required by the FMLA. And so even if an employee has burned through all of their FMLA leave, if there is still a disabling condition that requires an accommodation, then you have to take a look at whether additional leave is, in fact, reasonable. And if it is, then you have to grant it, even under the Rehab Act.
All right, any additional questions, Marissa? We're getting
about
5 minutes out from our close.
I don't think so. If you've got any more questions, please go ahead and type them into that chat area.
This will be your last chance, folks.
Okay.
And if we don't have questions here in the next minute or so, I think we should go ahead and begin to close. We will endeavor to answer those questions that would come in after the cutoff time, as is our practice.
Okay, I don't think we've got any more questions. So
can you advance to slide 11 if it's not already done?
I sure will.
Slide 11. Oh.
Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and conclude today's webinar. We realize that you may have had some questions for our presenters, so we apologize if there's anything we didn't get to, although I think we did. again, the presenters have provided us with their contact information. Let me see if we've got it up there. If not, we'll provide it.
Marissa, we don't have the contact information.
I think we're missing some information there, but we'll go ahead and post that information, if that's okay with you all, later on, along with the archive. Again, we want to thank our presenters, Aaron McCullough, Marty Abel, and Jeanette Cox, for sharing your time and your extensive knowledge with us today. Just a quick reminder again that today's session was recorded and it will be available for viewing within the next 24 hours at www.ada-audio.org/archives/ADA Legal/. Again, we invite you to join us for our next scheduled session on September 19th, which is titled Update on Emerging ADA Issues, Disability Harassment, Retaliation, and Constructive Discharge. For any questions regarding this or other sessions in the series, you can direct those to 877-232-1990 or via email at adaconferences@adagreatlakes.org. Let me see here. I know there was something that Jeanette wanted to share with everyone for additional reading. We've got it up there. She does recommend the report written by Equal Rights Advocates. We've got the link up there, and we'll probably post it later on as well on the archives. You will receive a link to the evaluation via email at the conclusion of today's program. We encourage you to participate and share your thoughts regarding the session. We're also preparing our schedule for the next program year starting October 1st and welcome your suggestions regarding topics. Again, thank you to everyone who joined us today. Thank you to our presenters. Please feel free to share your thoughts with us via the evaluation form and or via email at adaconferences@adagreatlakes.org. Thanks again, everyone. You can now disconnect your browsers.